Welcome to this Touch Podcast activity, which has been recorded for Touch Respiratory. This podcast aims to provide an update on the optimal management of severe pediatric asthma. Pediatric asthma expert Dr. Leonard Bacaria from the USA and primary care respiratory specialist Dr. Dermot Ryan from the UK respond to questions from healthcare professionals involved in the care of pediatric patients with severe asthma. The questions cover the symptoms associated with severe asthma in children, the clinical evidence supporting the use of biologics in children with severe asthma, and the optimal long-term management of children with severe asthma. This activity is funded by an independent medical education grant from Sanofi and Regeneron Pharmaceuticals and is jointly provided by USF Health and Touch IME.
Hello and welcome to this Touch-In conversation activity. My name is Dermot Ryan. I've been a general practitioner in the UK for about 30 years and I'm an honorary research fellow at the University of Edinburgh in Scotland. Today I'm joined by Dr. Len Bacaria, a paediatric allergist and immunologist and professor of paediatrics at Vanderbilt University Medical Center in Tennessee in the United States. Today we're going to discuss how we can improve outcomes in severe paediatric asthma and to discuss what the new treatments and possibilities might be. So let's just think about how asthma may present in children at the doctor's surgery or clinic. It does vary somewhat between the different ages, and it's very, very important to remember, and particularly in the preschoolers, that repeated viral infections may mimic asthma with consistent or persistent wheeze, which has actually been induced by the virus rather than by asthma per se. And it is more common in boys and in girls because they have smaller airways under puberty than girls have. We should also remember that allergic rhinitis frequently precedes asthma and that symptoms are often worse at night, so nocturnal coughing, wheezing, tight-chestedness may be a concomitant symptom with people with asthma. We should think about what things may precipitate the symptoms. So exercise is a very common precipitant, so the child is running around and starts coughing or wheezing or feeling tight-chested. Airborne allergens, particularly with distant season allergens. Viral infections, particularly again going back to school in September, and secondhand smoke. So incorporating the parents and assisting the management by smoking outside the house, or better still, giving it altogether. And temperature changes may also precipitate acute bronchospasm. So going from a warm house out into the cold outside during winter may cause a recurrence of symptoms. So diagnosing severe asthma means that first of all, we have to diagnose asthma. So the patient presents with symptoms, wheeze, shortness of breath, chest tightness and cough. You take a detailed history and perform a physical examination. Variability of lung function is demonstrated by one or more of the following. A positive bronchodilator responsiveness, positive exercise challenge, the 6-minute test, excessive variation in lung function, and significant increase in lung function after 4 weeks of anti-inflammatory treatment. If that option is chosen, it's very important to withdraw the treatment to see whether the lung function deteriorates again and the symptoms recur. And it should be accompanied by expiratory airflow limitation. That's the FEV1 FEC reduced compared to the lower limit of normal of greater than 0.9 in children. If the bronchodilator response is negative, then it's important to repeat it again at a time when the child is symptomatic. Perhaps one of the reasons why we get negative bronchodilator challenge tests is because they're done when the child is stable. So initial asthma treatment is based on inhaled corticosteroids with or without a LABA. And it's very important to note that these should be a rapid onset action LABA. If people don't respond to treatment, then we need to think, what is going on? If they don't respond to treatment, it means they're uncontrolled. Control looks like somebody who has no symptoms, no requirement for short-acting beta agonists, and no requirement for bursts of oral steroids. So the first thing you need to do, looking at a person with uncontrolled asthma, is to determine whether the diagnosis is correct. And certainly in primary care, wrong diagnosis occurs in between 30 and 50% of patients. And that's usually because airway variability or reversibility has not been demonstrated. Next, check inhaler technique. It's very important that the clinician knows how to use an inhaler and how to check inhaler technique. Make sure that treatment is being adhered to. Simple questioning helps, but you need to sometimes question the veracity of the answers received. If there's any multimorbidity, that also needs to be corrected, particularly allergic rhinitis, and try and remove any ongoing allergen or irritant in the room. If by correcting these things, you have somebody who is still uncontrolled, and that includes sometimes increasing the dose of medication, then you're left with a subset of patients with severe asthma. So, Dr. Beccaria, let's look at some of the questions submitted by our audience. Firstly, what are the characteristic symptoms of severe asthma in children?
So I think you've very nicely outlined the general symptom patterns that we see, and I think it's important that we acknowledge that they vary by age. But the symptoms of severe asthma are really pretty universal across the age spectrum. It's recurrent episodes of cough, wheeze, chest tightness, and difficulty breathing that come and go based on exposure to triggering factors, and that are punctuated by exacerbations of marked increase in severity associated with hypoxemia, greater difficulty breathing, greater chest tightness, and need for more intensive therapy. As we move into the preschool children, some of these are a little more challenging to detect. It really is incumbent on the parent to provide a quality set of observations. It really helps us understand what they're seeing and what they're perceiving. And then we talk to the children in terms that they understand in an effort to really try to tease out what they're feeling and what they're not. Because sometimes children can't report wheezing, they don't know what it is, but with the appropriate coaching, you can really begin to understand what they're experiencing.
So what would you suggest is the diagnostic pathway for identifying patients with severe asthma?
So I think you've done a very nice job of reminding us of the testing that goes into this, but asthma remains a clinical diagnosis. It's a disorder of relapsing episodes of chest symptoms that are historically responsive to asthma-related therapies that are generally accompanied by evidence of airflow limitation that is variably and responsive to bronchodilators or steroids. But in children, particularly those with mild disease, some of these are really a bit challenging to actually document over time. You may need to look at them several times. You may need to look at them in the setting of an acute episode and be very holistic in your view, because very few children actually check all the boxes. And I think that's really key, is understanding how many of these features are necessary to really feel comfortable with the diagnosis of asthma.
And to some extent, that's one of the luxuries we have in primary care, in that we can afford to make the diagnosis over an extended period of time, maybe after repeated consultations, which may be frustrating for the parents, but it's necessary to get the diagnosis right. How can we differentiate asthma from other similar conditions, and what biomarkers could be useful?
Yeah, so, you know, in childhood, there is an absolute differential for recurrent chest symptoms. Asthma is often at the top of that differential, but it is followed by chronic disorders such as cystic fibrosis, primary ciliary dyskinesia. We need to remember that children do aspirate foreign bodies, and that leads to recurrent chest episodes. So it remains a diagnosis that demands full attention to a differential diagnosis and a thoughtful pathway that includes clinical history. In children with recurrent episodes, I always have a chest radiograph to confirm normal anatomy. Allergy evaluation is often helpful, because the vast majority of childhood asthma cases are associated with allergic disease. So the presence of coexisting allergic disease in the form of atopic dermatitis, food allergy, allergic rhinitis is often helpful. And then evaluation, I think, as we're going to discuss, for the markers of allergic inflammation or type 2 inflammation, such as blood eosinophil counts or IgE levels, is often supportive in most cases of childhood asthma.
And finally, what are the implications of long-term inhaled or oral corticosteroid treatment for the treatment of severe asthma?
Yeah, so inhaled corticosteroids are really the cornerstone of asthma therapy, and nearly every patient, and is reinforced by the GINA document, really do require some availability of inhaled corticosteroids, be that intermittently or continuously. And certainly in patients with severe asthma, continuous use of an inhaled corticosteroid is essential, generally accompanied by a second or often a third controller. All of this is intended to minimize their risk of exacerbation and their daytime and nighttime symptom patterns. We know that oral corticosteroids provide cumulative toxicity to patients, and our real goal should be the absolute minimization of oral corticosteroids. We are now in an era of oral corticosteroid stewardship, not dissimilar to what we have evolved into for antibiotics, and really being thoughtful and judicious in their use based on a lot of emerging data that suggest and indicate that over time, chronic or repetitive bursts of oral corticosteroids do have substantial cumulative side effects that we would very much prefer to avoid.
So the corollary of that is, in patients in whom we gain control, that after a period of control, we should seek to reduce the dose of inhaled steroids that they're taking. But clearly those who we can't gain control in, we need to perhaps send off to see somebody like yourself.
I think that's very appropriate. And I'm glad you brought up the concept of stepping down therapy. I think it's very important, especially in childhood, where we've learned over time that disease severity does modulate, and the opportunity to titrate therapy to the level of acute disease activity, I think, is really quite important.
Thank you very much. Biologics for severe pediatric asthma. So the GINA strategy recommends a stepwise approach to managing asthma, starting with low-dose inhaled corticosteroids, going through the different steps, and ending up at step 5, which usually includes high-dose inhaled corticosteroids with a LABA, plus or minus other medications. And these are the children who probably require consideration for add-on biologic treatment. In addition, most children will have short-acting beta agonist, but it is recommended in the strategy that a dose of inhaled corticosteroid is taken at any time that a SABA dose is taken. Of course, if the patient is on maintenance and reliever therapy, the dose fulfillment of the additional inhaled steroid is taken care of because it's combined with the LABA. So there are quite a few biologics now available, and they work on different steps of the inflammatory pathway, and Dr. Beccario will address that in a few minutes. There are slight different choices, again, at different ages, in keeping with the fact that asthma develops over a period of time and seems to have slightly different pathways as a child or the organism matures. So, Dr. Beccario, let's look at some of the questions submitted by our audience and the role of biologic treatments in the management of severe asthma in children. What do the clinical data say about the efficacy of biologics in children with severe asthma?
So this has really been a major advance in our capacity to provide excellent asthma care and asthma control for children. Over the last 5 to 10 years, we've now seen the approval of at least 3 biologics in children as young as 6 years of age with severe asthma, and an additional 2 biologics approved in adolescents. So we really do have some very effective options for the add-on when patients are not well controlled despite the standard of care that you've described. These biologics consistently reduce the risk of exacerbation relative to placebo by somewhere between 25 and 70%, depending on the population studied, the drug studied, the duration, and some of the patient characteristics that go into the populations that were studied. We see this largely in pediatrics as a result of controlled clinical trials, but there's now been substantial clinical experience with multiple biologics in children. And the general experience has been very consistent with the clinical trial findings in that children treated with biologics experience substantial improvements in exacerbation reduction, in improvements in asthma control, and with some of the agents, substantial improvements in lung function. That's not to say that every child experiences all of those responses. They are a bit more variable, but I think over time, nearly every child with severe type 2 asthma, there is a biologic that would produce very substantial clinical effect.
And is there any evidence for a reduction in steroid dosage with successful treatment with one of these biologics?
So none of the pediatric trials have examined children who were maintained on chronic oral steroids. Several of these have been studied in adults maintained on chronic oral steroids, and some but not all have demonstrated the ability to reduce chronic oral steroid dosing. That being said, the most common pattern of oral steroid use in children is that used for acute exacerbations. And we see that with all of the approved biologics, there is a substantial, usually around halving of their corticosteroid exposure over a given year. So there really is a reduction in corticosteroid exposure, mostly from the prevention of exacerbations.
Thank you. So what do the guidelines say about when patients should be initiated on biologic therapies, and how can we identify suitable patients?
Sure. So what we first need to identify and think through is the discussion we had earlier. Is it asthma? Are all the other coexisting and comorbid conditions well addressed, well managed? Is adherence and inhaler technique optimized? When it's clear that we have done our very best with those factors, when we've addressed the home environment, when we've done everything else possible, and asthma control is still below the level at which we would view it as well controlled, we would then begin to consider a biologic because it really is most appropriate for patients with severe uncontrolled disease. In order to identify patients, we now perform phenotypic analysis because we know that these biologic agents target specific immunologic pathways that aren't expressed in all individuals and aren't expressed equally in individuals. So we would phenotype patients by testing such as blood eosinophil levels, which have been shown to be predictive of response to many of the biologics, to fractional exhaled nitric oxide, which predicts response to anti-IL-4, anti-IL-13 inhibition and anti-IgE therapy, and IgE pathway activity, generally reflected by positive skin tests or positive serum-specific IgE levels. And then based on that, if patients demonstrate evidence of allergic sensitization, then assessment of a total IgE is necessary to determine suitability for anti-IgE therapy.
What biomarkers are best suited to reliably predict therapeutic success and improvements in the quality of life in these patients?
So these biologics that we have for children entirely target type 2 pathways. So we look for biomarkers that are reflective of type 2 inflammation. The most widely available, used, and studied is the peripheral blood eosinophil count. Peripheral blood eosinophil counts in excess of 150 are highly predictive of response to anti-IL-5 therapy, anti-IL-4 therapy, and even anti-IgE therapy. FeNO levels in excess of 20 are reliably predictive of clinical response to anti-IL-4, IL-13 inhibition. And the evidence of allergic sensitization is essential for The use of omalizumab, but the extent of allergic sensitization in terms of number of skin tests or total IgE is actually non-predictive of omalizumab response. It is the total IgE is used for determination of dosing, not as a predictor of efficacy. In contrast, the higher the eosinophil count, the more likely and generally the greater the response to these therapies. And for those biologics for which FeNO is a predictor, the same general pattern holds. The higher the level, the greater the response.
And what is the safety profile of biologic therapies for children with severe asthma? And what is known about the long-term safety of applying these?
Yeah, so these are really essential points when we're discussing these therapies in children. We've had these agents for variable periods of time, and most of the clinical trials for these agents were 12 months of duration or shorter. So we really can only speak to the long-term safety profiles for those that have been on the market for the longest period of time, such as omalizumab, and the recently published open-label second-year therapy, the excursion trial related to anti-IL-4, anti-IL-13. What we have learned in aggregate, though, is that these therapies really do have a very favorable risk-benefit ratio. The side effect profiles generally include injection site reactions, which are almost always mild to moderate and tolerable, with rare discontinuations. Anaphylaxis has been reported in the setting of omalizumab, requires the availability of an epinephrine auto-injector, but is a very uncommon outcome. Each of the agents have some specific side effects that have been identified over time. They're all generally uncommon. Mepolizumab has been associated with zoster infections in adults. Dupilumab has been associated with a rise in peripheral blood eosinophil counts and a potentially increased risk of parasitic infection, although most of the patients who developed mild parasitic infection were those who lived in areas with those infections or infestations being endemic. So I think in aggregate, when we look at the side effect profile of these agents, it's actually very manageable and acceptable. And when we look at it relative to the exposure to repeated courses of oral corticosteroids and the long-term downstream effects of those therapies, the balance to me is very clearly in favor of the biologics. It requires shared decision-making and very clear expectation setting and monitoring, but on the whole, the side effect profiles are very well tolerated and are rarely a cause for stopping therapy in children.
And I would expect that most parents would be delighted to see a reduction in the steroid exposure of their children.
Exactly.
Thank you. The optimal management of severe pediatric asthma. Well, the first thing is modifying the risk factors which we can identify once we've ensured that the diagnosis is correct. Certainly looking at medication and particularly the overuse of SABAs, the treatment and management of any comorbidity that the child may have, poor adherence to treatment, and don't forget that in the younger children in particular, the parents will be responsible for giving the medication or making sure the medication is taken. And environmental exposure at home, in particular, again, passive smoking in the home, mold in the home, air pollution, people who live near busy roads in particular seem to be at higher risk of developing disease. So the GINA strategy suggests avoiding risk factors as much as possible, and that this should help to alleviate asthma symptoms. Of course, it's not always very easy to get people to move their homes. So let's ask Dr. Beccario some questions submitted by our audience on how we can optimize the management of children with severe asthma. Firstly, how can we monitor response to therapy and identify when patients may need treatment escalation?
So, we start this discussion by reminding ourselves that asthma is a chronic disorder, and it is not a disorder of acute episodes. And that means it requires scheduled pre-planned follow-up. both in the primary care setting and for patients with more severe disease with the aid of a subspecialist. Because if we only see our patients when they're in the midst of a flare, we are going to do a terrible job of achieving control, and we are going to reinforce that those episodes are actually the expected outcome. So I think that the most essential part of monitoring response to therapy is pre-planned regular follow-up. When we do that, we want to use validated tools to help us assess levels of control, such as asthma control test, asthma control questionnaire. And we really want to monitor lung function to determine that there isn't a decline of lung function over time. And I think this all is most effectively done in partnership between the family, the primary care team, and subspecialists when involved. Because I think we all bring something different to the discussion. We all have different availabilities in the setting of acute episodes. And I think this is really the most effective strategy for the long-term management of our patients.
And of course, those reviews should be structured. So follow a similar pattern, looking at adherence, looking at inhaler technique, and looking at the removal of any triggers that the child may encounter. So for patients already receiving a biologic who may not be responding to that biologic, when should we give consideration to switching that biologic to another agent?
So, you know, we really need to define what it means to be responding or not responding. When we look at the clinical trial data, we see that the biologics reduce the rate of exacerbation by about 50% on average. So many patients who are initiated on a biologic are still going to have the occasional breakthrough exacerbation. I would not view that as a treatment failure. I would not call that non-response. If they are experiencing half or fewer of exacerbations relative to their baseline, to me, that's response. But some patients just don't achieve that for whatever reason, or they experience an exacerbation reduction but still maintain some chronic symptom burden. Then we start to think about whether they should receive a different biologic. I think the shortest period of time to assess this is 4 to 6 months. If you're seeing an improvement, I would extend it for another 4 to 6 months to determine a full year's worth of therapy and how things go. But we know that our patients, you know, have seasonal variability, and sometimes they have an exacerbation because you started it right at the beginning of viral season. You're worried it isn't going to be effective, but then you realize the rest of the year they've been exacerbation free. Several of the studies have shown that patients on biologics, at least 70% and sometimes higher, don't experience an exacerbation at all within a one-year period. So I do think that that's our monitoring strategy. What we also need to remember is that these agents target similar but not identical pathways. And our biomarkers often identify multiple biologics that an individual patient could receive. So if a child is not achieving the desired response, I generally would switch to a different biologic from a different pathway, but that is also indicated by their biomarker profile, and then begin again, waiting 4 to 6 months and looking for response. While I do this, I also continue to work on the other factors, such as inhaled corticosteroid adherence, inhaler technique, environmental exposures, and comorbidities.
Might a period of rapid growth lead to loss of control because the dose is now inadequate?
So biologics in children are generally dosed nearly independent of weight. It's very different than how we care for and prescribe most other therapies. That is to say, though, that you need to know the dosing schedules for each of the biologics, because there are some weight considerations that need to come into play. Some of them are dosed in a age-dependent fashion. Some of them are a weight and age-dependent fashion. And some of them just have a fixed dose almost irrespective of this. So you really do need to think about that. But that is one of the considerations if a patient isn't having the desired response, is to consider changing the dose provided there was a change in weight or age category. It's a very good point. Thank you.
And what environmental risk factors may exacerbate patient symptoms? Clearly, you've talked about the viral season, and I dare say there are different allergy seasons in different parts of your vast country in particular.
Yes, yeah, so we definitely know that asthma is largely an environmental disorder. We know that allergen exposure is important. We know that pollution exposure is important. There's clear data linking ozone exposure to exacerbation risk. There are beautiful data showing that following particularly intense thunderstorms, asthma exacerbation risk is augmented. Indoor pollution such as cigarette smoke, and in parts of the world where biomass is used to heat the homes and used as cooking sources, that can also augment exacerbation risk. But, you know, viral infections still lead the list for their risk triggering episodes. We've got immunization that reduces viral infection risk. So yearly influenza vaccination is recommended. COVID immunization, staying up to date, is also a recommended strategy.
And how can we as healthcare professionals better involve parents, our carers of the children, in the treatment decisions and ongoing support for self-management?
So we really do need to be cognizant of all that we know as pediatricians. We need to recognize that there is a developmental pattern that children go through, and that some children are more or less capable of executing some of the asthma treatment behaviors than others. Many a family equates the ability to physically use an inhaler with the knowledge of how, when to use it, and to use it regularly, even when they're feeling well. So I recommend families, especially of school-age children and younger, all asthma administration is supervised. The children are not encouraged to use medication on their own. We work with families to set appropriate goals and expectations so that they understand what appropriate and inadequate asthma control looks like. We bring them back regularly to reinforce inhaler technique. We have often enlisted the help of school nurses, where children can help get medications when the home life presents challenges to that. We may need to involve the extended family and other family members to really help form an asthma community around the child to optimize their use of medications and any other strategy that could improve the environment in which they live.
So I guess part of that is pointing out the potential rewards to the individual patient in terms of being able to play sports or more or less to do what they want to do instead of having their lifestyle inhibited by a disease which they don't really want to have.
Precisely.
Thank you very much. In conclusion, severe pediatric asthma is a challenge, but there are steps we can make to ameliorate the problems caused by that. Some in primary care, by a systematic review of the individual patient, addressing the problems which can be addressed, allergic rhinitis, inhaler technique, adherence, and referring to a specialist when we don't succeed in getting control of the asthma. And I'd like to thank Dr. Beccaria today for having joined us and given us his expert opinion on severe pediatric asthma and explaining to us the different new possibilities which are available and the benefits they can bring to our patients with severe asthma. So it's very important for us to recognise when we have patients with severe asthma and refer to Dr. Beccaria and his other specialist colleagues throughout the country in order to ameliorate the lot of the patient with severe pediatric asthma. And thank you to all of you for having stayed the course and listened to this. And I hope that you'll be able to employ the knowledge you have gained today in the practice of your patients and to help them to meet the needs which they have. Thank you very much.
Thank you to you both, and thank you to our audience for listening to this Touch podcast. You can access more content on severe asthma on Touch Respiratory at www.touchrespiratory.com.